Welcome to episode 36 of Climate Champions. I'm Lee Krivat, and each week I publish a new episode with a new climate champion as my guest. This week's guest is Pip Decker, Senior Vice President at BMR Energy. If you or someone you know is a climate champion, please let me know at www.krivatenergyinnovations.com. And if you're free later this week, please consider attending the 17th World Summit of Nobel Peace Laureates taking place in the land of the Maya, the beautiful city of Mérida, Yucatán, in Mexico. The summit has a strong focus on climate change, and there will be a climate strike to support youth in their climate quest on September 20th at 8 a.m. The same day will feature a forum with Nobel Peace Laureates and climate change experts aiming to increase partnerships and action towards mitigating climate change and maintaining the beauty of our gorgeous planet. Founded in 2014, BMR Energy brings the combined expertise of 10,000 megawatts of energy infrastructure projects, local insight, and access to reliable capital backed by Virgin Investments to the development, acquisition, finance, construction, and operations of energy infrastructure throughout the Caribbean and Central America. Pip Decker has deep experience in the development, construction, and operation of wind and solar PV power generation projects. Prior to BMR Energy, Pip owned U.S.-based solar developer SunEast LLC. Pip has also served as engineering and construction manager for Brookfield Renewable Power and director of development for Noble Environment Power, where he developed, constructed, and operated wind generation facilities throughout the northeastern U.S. Pip has a bachelor's degree in public policy from the College of William & Mary. Welcome to Climate Champions. I'm here in New York talking to Pip Decker, the Senior Vice President at BMR Energy. Pip, welcome to Climate Champions.
Thank you for having me, Lee. I really appreciate it.
Can you talk about your motivating moment with regards to climate change, when you thought you wanted to engage and do something about it?
I think it was a long time ago. We used to take elementary school trips down to various science centers. We went to the Philadelphia Science Center. I think it was in second grade. And when I was there, we watched this space shuttle climb out of the atmosphere. And I looked at all the exhaust and pollution that was coming from it. And I thought it was inefficient. And I thought that if I could do something that didn't utilize all those resources kind of wastefully in a way, that I could make a really great life for myself. And I think that was really a motivating factor a really, really long time ago. And I always think about that space shuttle climbing into the sky as one of the earliest memories that I had of wanting to be part of the energy space and tackling climate change.
What grade were you in for that?
I was in second grade.
That was really early.
Yeah.
For me, it wasn't nearly as early. But when I look at cars, non-electric cars, and I understand electric cars have their own issues, but I just look at the exhaust and I think, oh my God, the stuff that's killing us is coming out, and yet we just drive around.
There's this theory out there of no moving parts, and the great advances in technology occurred when things were taken to no moving parts. And so Apple was successful because they took CDs and vinyl and tape decks and stopped making them move. And if you follow that chain of thought, by stopping the internal combustion engine from moving and taking it to a static, drive by electric wire, the same thing will happen, no moving parts, but we've optimized that transport method. Solar is the same, no moving parts, no extraction. We're just harnessing the sun's energy and converting it.
You do a lot of wind. Wind has moving parts.
Wind has fewer moving parts.
Okay.
So I would say, internal combustion versus wind, fewer moving parts. But again, we're not extracting anything from the earth. We're on top of it and making the best use of it that we can.
Your motivating moment was very personal. Can you talk about why climate change mitigation is personally important to you?
It's personally important to me because I think about the communities in which we serve and giving them something to look forward to, that they're part of this change. When I think about the wind farm that we developed in Jamaica, we're bringing them hope in the sense that they're directly part of the next leg in the energy journey. And so when I think about the immediate surroundings of the projects that I've been part of, You know, I can trace it back to the dairy farmers in upstate New York that I first worked with very early on, where not only were they receiving valuable income and life-saving income from the windmills we were putting up, but we were the first thing to be going up in the sky versus things coming down. It's to really to be a beacon. It's really to be a sign of hope that people like us can come in, and if we do projects the right way, everyone can benefit. If we're going to offset CO2 emissions and everything else, we're going to also bring low-cost power and jobs into these communities.
Yeah, when you talk about replacing on an island diesel with wind power, and we were just talking about the space shuttle polluting, that diesel is really bad. That's crazy polluting right there.
The thing here to remember too is that we're competing in the Caribbean on a pound-for-pound basis that's unsubsidized. And so we're not going in and saying we need help from the government. We're going in and we're saying we're going to bring down your energy costs. And so BMR Energy, we're clean energy delivered. We get it done and get the projects up and running in a pretty record time. Wind project in Jamaica we built, you know, we got it done in about a year and a half once we signed our PPA, and that's pretty quick. So when I think of the speed at which we're working, it's pretty good, but at the same time, the impact and immediate carbon offsets are really tremendous, and we're doing it on an unsubsidized basis.
When you meet people that don't believe in climate change and don't believe this is necessary, how do you explain to them how important it is?
It's really about the project for me. And so when I deal with folks that have an issue, you can look at our wind turbines two ways. That they're an incredible eyesore and they don't want to see it. And it should just come from somewhere else. But the people that I focus on and that give me the resiliency to carry on, it was a town hall meeting regarding a transmission line in Manchester Parish. And it was a Rastafarian who had come up to me and he said, "Man, I support you. You are harnessing God's will through energy. It's the wind, man. He provided it for us. And you are here to harness it. God bless you." It was incredible.
Wow.
It's renewable energy. It's the best kind of energy we could have. And in that evening, there were protesters, but all I could remember was him. And so some people will take the people that don't like you out of that meeting, but I took him, and you know, he kind of sits up in my little toolbox of people that I want to hear about and have heard about, you know, to kind of keep me rolling. And I think those are the people that gave me the courage to say, no matter what we're working on is the right track. And sometimes when you're early in on something, not everyone believes and sees, but you can also trace, you know, the edges of our ecosystem and how they're fundamentally changing, and they're starting to become real data that's available, that's proving out that as salt marshes and wetland marshes dry up, there's less rodents that are in these marshes for avian species to come down and feed from. So there are serious pieces of data that are being published now that are proving out the story of climate change that are very alarming and real, but are only at the edges of our life. And so I'm okay with directly impacting people's lives for the better. If I have to take some slings and arrows along the way, so what?
Have you had any converts, people that didn't believe in climate change, and you were able to get them to the point where they did?
I have. It was in upstate New Hampshire in Coos County. There was a series of folks that were very close to this wind farm I was developing called Granite Reliable Power. And I'll never forget, we had these visual simulations that were out during a public hearing showing what the wind farm would look like. And honestly, I felt like they looked beautiful. But I remember this one woman, God bless her, and she came up and in front of about 150 people at the public hearing, including my boss and, you know, local firemen and everybody else, said, "Pip, you lied to me. And you said these windmills," he's like, "they don't look good at all. And they're going to be so close to my house. And I just don't want to see it. I don't believe in any of this stuff." And I said, "That's okay." And I remember that night going home and I thought what I was doing maybe wasn't the best thing. But again, you have to be resilient and you have to take these issues on. And so I rented a bus and we went 3.5 hours across to our wind farms that were standing and operating in Clinton County, just west of Plattsburgh. And we had all 30 of the local residents, including this lady, come and see our windmills. And she looked at me and she said, "You know what? They're beautiful." And if I hadn't rented that bus, and we also watched miracle on the way over to get people in a good mood because we're near Lake Placid in upstate New York. And we hadn't got out of that bus and hit that issue head on. You know, I would have been in fear of her and what she had to say, but I think seeing is believing. And so when you take people to these projects and you show them what they truly are, that's the best way to convert anybody, is to tap on it. It's a real thing. It's not something that's in your imagination.
That's the second time in a few weeks I've heard the thought that visibility can make change happen. I was talking to Bernadette Del Chiaro, the executive director of the California Solar and Storage Association, and she said her vision is to have solar panels on every roof, electric vehicle in every driveway, so that neighbors can see neighbors have this stuff and use this stuff, and it can spread through visibility.
It's definitely the shiny new penny, but there are many more pennies, to use that analogy, that are out there now. And so you see more people driving Teslas, and you see more people having solar in their backyards. In fact, we have a family farm, and we're 100% solar in New York State, and we love it. And we put it on Instagram, and we want to share this because our kids think it's just a natural thing. It's just, oh, it's normal now. But you know, 15 years ago, when I first got in the business, it was not. And there were all these articles about doom and gloom, and guess what? It never happened.
Thank you for persevering through those times, by the way.
Oh, it's exciting.
So can you talk about what you do at BMR Energy?
Yeah, I would say at BMR, my role is really to lead with my team the development effort of new projects in the Caribbean and Latin America. We're led by Bruce Levy, incredible CEO, and the amount of energy he brings to our company is just tremendous. And so we focus on either new projects, you know, taking something from nothing, so turning over rocks, but at the same time enhancing other people's projects. So we will start a project from scratch, like we did in Jamaica, where it's just land, and we'll bring all of our personal expertise of siting wind turbines, of selecting the right technology, getting the permits, working with the local community, safely constructing that facility, and then operating it. So we have 50 megawatts of operating capacity. We have three solar projects about the same size, one in Guatemala, one in St. Croix, as I said earlier, in Grand Cayman, and then in Jamaica. So we spend an incredible amount of time in these islands. I just got back yesterday from the Bahamas, you know, supporting basically low-cost power efforts. I mean, either with a utility or a direct commercial customer. But, you know, for us is really about saving all of these islands fuel consumption or diesel usage and replacing them with renewables.
So when you go to these islands, doesn't it scare you? I'm asking because we just had 90 degrees in Anchorage, Alaska. Greenland is visibly melting, hardcore melting. Yeah. Do you get nervous for these people?
I do. And it's concerning. It's very hot down there right now. It's unseasonably hot. I was in Grand Cayman 2 weeks ago. You can feel the heat. And I think you can look at this, again, two ways. You can be fearful of it, or you can hit these problems head on and give you more strength to say, well, let's go plan a more ambitious project. Let's try to make batteries more integrated in this solar effort to, again, provide resiliency, but again, reduce fuel consumption and push more towards renewables. So when I think about picking up the phone to a certain person in St. Lucia because I want to get that land opportunity realized, or down in Barbados to help them get towards their 100% goal of carbon neutrality, it just provides more fuel to my fire. I think that's how I look at it. But yeah, it certainly is concerning, but you can only control what's your immediate project. And if you can execute on that project, you made a difference.
Can you talk about your journey to BMR, the things that you did to get here?
Well, so the space shuttle story never left the back of my mind.
That was second grade. So you were like seven.
And then, but I'm not an engineer. I came up on the other side of regulatory affairs and economics, and I got a public policy degree. And I think, you know, for your listeners out there, if you're not an engineer, that's okay. You can still get in this game. You can still be a great project developer. And for me, focusing on projects, there's a beginning, a middle, and an end, and there's a result, and you can tap on it. And I think that, you know, some people pursue a digital experience. I wanted a physical experience. My grandfather ran a tunneling company. And I remember as a kid sitting on his oil barrels and watching him work on big gear. And I thought, wow, if I could do big, working on big gear, big projects and renewables, I've got it made. But it wasn't easy. And I got a lot of no's when I graduated. I didn't have a job, but I didn't give up. And I never forget, I interviewed with this guy, his name was Charlie, and I thought I was a shoo-in for this job. I thought surely I could help him work on his wind projects in New York. But I remember when I was interviewing with him, I wrote down all the competitors that he was facing in his market, because he said there were other wind companies out there. And I wrote down JP Morgan / Noble. And that company was called Noble Environmental Power, and I cold called him one night out of sheer frustration because I knew this is what I wanted to do. And I called and they said, well, we're not really hiring anybody, but send us your resume. And do you have any land? I said, no, I don't have any land. Well, they go, well, we're looking for landowners to put windmills on their property. And I said, well, I can do that. I can help you with that. And I was living in New York City in the West Village. And they said, well, you have to move to the outskirts of Northern New York along the Canadian border. Are you in? And I said, hell yeah, man, let's go. And like the rest is history, right? Like it's an incredible story. So I was part of this company and we put up over 700 megawatts of wind in Texas and New York. At that time, we're the largest wind provider in New York State. And we were growing like crazy. And I was sent over to New Hampshire to run an office in Lancaster, New Hampshire. I became a resident. It was great, no state income tax.
But you moved back.
I would go home on the weekends. But my dad always said, look, New York's always going to be here. And we were just talking earlier before you came. The Upper West Side's great, but it can be a little bit of a cocoon. And so the great adventures are beyond Manhattan. So, man, I got it. I got this big adventure. And I led a development effort of a 99-megawatt wind power facility from scratch. I put up the first Met Tower. And I had an army of amazing consultants, many of which were local, that I found in Littleton and Concord, and helped work on getting the RPS enacted and provided public testimony for that, and really worked on the framework of getting projects done. And ultimately that project was purchased by Brookfield Power and we got it built. I got to bring my dad out to the project site when it was getting built and my wife, and show him 33 windmills across 21 linear miles of hard granite rock that we built, that I think is just tremendous. And hopefully the folks of COAS, you know, if you have some listeners there, what a tremendous place to work in and get a project done. And I just really wanted to continue that effort. And I was lucky to link up with Bruce and Andy. And there was an opportunity down in Jamaica to help them bring down their energy costs. And BMR was kind of formed from just putting together, again, another greenfield opportunity. And I used basically my knowledge of how you put projects together successfully in the Northeast, which is a very hard permitting regime, and just make it happen in Jamaica once again. And you know, you always want to make that next project better. And for me, that has been kind of my track record for the last 15 years, is just creating great projects and really doing a lot of good along the way.
Can you talk about some setbacks that you've had along the way?
Sure. Project in New Hampshire was appealed by some folks that didn't like the project. And we also went through a financial crisis at the same time. And so when projects, you know, as you know, they get closer and closer to the finish line, the spend curve goes up, the development costs go up, and things become a lot more real and more expensive. But when I think about all these projects, there are so many setbacks along the way. In Jamaica, I'll give you an example. We were working on physically interconnecting the wind facility to the substation, which is 18 kilometers away and goes up one mountain and down one mountain and through five communities. And the utility initially sited the line, and it turned out there were going to be 256 individual parcels we were going to have to cross, and we were going to have to get easements or right-of-way agreements struck with all the landowners. If any developers are out there and they know how long that can take, that's daunting. And a project unto itself was me working with local landowners and trying to figure out how many different right-of-ways do we need, how do we get from point A to B, and just kind of utilizing a little horse sense in terms of better optimization and planning. And when I was done, I only needed three landowners.
Wow, that's incredible.
Yeah. And so
I asked for a setback, by the way.
So the setback was when you face, So, but there are so many stories like that I've had where another one of my buddies, his name's Dan, he and I, you know, went and we had to sign this one landowner where there were four landowners on one title, and this one landowner, his three brothers, they don't speak to each other. And when we showed up in this neighboring county with him and at his brother's house, I turn around, the state troopers are in the yard.
Wow.
And they said, I want nothing of this, guys. I said, look, we're just here to get some land signed. There's no issues. No one's fighting. And the stateies were like, all right, well. And they followed us out of that county that day to make sure there was no issue. But, you know, I can tell you story after story. But, like, I mean, that's what's great about it. I mean, the odds are so high against you sometimes on these development projects. And you add in the Caribbean element and they get even higher. But when you get done, and the simplicity of the project, I think, is what's so kind of mesmerizing in a way, is that you have this project that looks very clean and simple, but behind that are probably 1,000 stories like that where you thought you were dead and you've lived another day.
Yeah, sometimes it's exciting to have those hurdles in front of you, but I bet you'd rather not. I bet you wish that it was easier to get a project built.
Yeah, a touch of gray, right? I think that's how you earn your racing stripes in these markets.
You've talked about a number of exciting things that you've done. What success or successes are you most proud of?
Obviously, I think getting married, it was really helpful. I think having an anchor is really helpful. I think that if you don't have an anchor in your life, you can't go out and really create and really push the boundaries on things that are potentially intangible or not, you're not able to realize. I think you always need to go back to that anchor, whatever it is, if it's your farm or that place you grew up or the coffee shop or something that will keep you anchored so that you can really feel like you're pushing the boundary.
Yeah, I always felt that because of my wife, I could take any risk I wanted because she would always be there. And with that, nothing else really mattered. It could go up and down.
Yeah.
But I was always at a super high level because I had her.
When my wife was pregnant, I remember I wanted to go down to Jamaica and just make it happen. And I felt like I had more energy because of her in my life. And she was supporting me. And I went down that first year 40 times, 40 weeks, not in a row, but 40 over 52. So quite often. And she believed in it. And I think that gives you incredible strength. So I think that's really where a lot of this comes from.
Well, thank you for sharing that. That was great. Can you talk about your vision for the future? Where do you see the U.S. or the Earth in 30, 40 years with regards to climate change?
What's great about the energy market is that it moves slow, but it comes on like a crescendo. So what gives me hope is, you know, I looked this year, and I know the inverted yield curve is all the rage today on CNBC, but when you actually look at the curve of solar and wind installations, it too inverted this year, where you have actually had an incredible run of wind capacity additions for the last 15 years, basically, which is kind of when I got started. And now solar has now caught up and passed it in terms of cumulative megawatts installed. And so I see, again, just a sharp rise in solar PV being applied across the globe. I feel like in the markets that we're in, they're really starting to get it in a way that was very reminiscent of wind in 2005 in the United States, where it was kind of on the periphery. The utilities didn't know exactly how it could be integrated, and they just kind of threw their hands up like, well, it's too variable. But now it's becoming commonplace, and I think it will be even more so as, you know, building codes start to adopt southern-facing homes with solar as a mandate. And again, I do fall back on the thesis that no moving parts will prove out the day, that the drive towards efficiency is relentless. And so when you look at an internal combustion engine and all the moving parts there, it's just going to go away.
So you said you were really feeling the heat in the Cayman Islands, really feeling the heat, unseasonably hot. So is that going to get better quickly? And is that going to get better in time for that island?
We have to take climate change really seriously. And I think as islands hit their Paris Climate Accords, like Grand Cayman is taking it very seriously. I mean, I understand the United States hasn't joined in at this point, but, you know, all the islands that we work with have a very international lens. And I think that they know they've got to get there. Does it take longer an island time? Yeah, man. But at the same time, it's happening. And I think many of these islands you will see will be 50%, 75% renewable in that time span. And my hope is that you have this kind of cumulative effect where solar and wind, all of which, you know, you can look at Q positions in the United States and all these ISOs, if you just look at that being rolled on, you know, I'm hopeful that our carbon emissions will neutralize or start to recede. I think that's really the goal. I'm an excited realist, I guess, and I realize that there are certain intractable problems that take a lot longer to unlock. And I think, you know, I spent time in Port-au-Prince last year where it effectively is a small individualized diesel generator set times 10,000. And so these projects will take longer to fix and convert to solar. But what I did see the evenings I was in Port-au-Prince were people, despite the odds, putting solar panels on their roof. And so my hope and my belief is that everyone is talking about renewables being a net positive to their environment, and people are actually doing it. Does it get reported all the time? No, but that's okay, because I'd rather read about the aggregated story 5 years, 10 years down the road and have been part of it than not at all. And I think that gives me great hope at night that no matter what, my projects are spinning every night, my solar projects are up during the day, I was part of all of them. And I think the thing is that to your listeners, to really add that fuel to their future dreams of making what is a low carbon future possible and certainly attainable. There's no doubt we can do this. We just have to keep after it.
Do you have any questions for me?
What has been the common theme as you've embarked on your podcast journey? I mean, I think, you know, you get to see in a lens of so many different individuals across various scenescapes.
I've tried to summarize this in earlier episodes, but not for a while. So let me give it a shot now that I've talked to a lot more people. When I started the podcast, one of the things I really wanted people to answer was how they explain climate change to others in a way that convinces them. And what I've found is that most people I talk to are past that. There was a time when they tried to convince people, and many people have been convinced. But now the situation is so urgent and dire that it's time to build projects and make things happen and not worry about the minority that doesn't think it's something worth doing. So I think that's my little summary. I will say that one thing I've lately become nervous about is when the word urgency is used in the same sentence or paragraph or half-hour conversation as utilities and our dependence on them. That gets me a little bit nervous, because during my time at the utility, when I worked there, there were some things we did with urgency, but most utilities did most things slowly based on a cultural need of safety, so I'm not holding it against them, but I'm not sure that urgency and utilities go together very well.
Yeah, I hear you. I also think about Kraft Heinz a little bit right now, where, I mean, look at their market cap getting just decimated by millennials, and look at the opportunities that people have now to just change consumer behavior dramatically and almost overnight, it feels, right? And so when you look at this new cohort of people coming through and beginning to like lock into homes and buying cars, it just feels like renewable energy is just part of what they're going to consume. And so consumer behavior, I think, in the United States is starting to get ads on Instagram for be 50% renewable, just click here, and how seamlessly you can do it. And the consumer behavior model shouldn't be overlooked in pushing these utilities to just keep up or fade away. And once impenetrable moat businesses, they're no longer really that immune to these disruptions and changes, and I think it's going to be really good. I am hopeful that, you know, the young kids that are coming out have come up and seen this and they want to do something about it. And now they can through buying things through an app, at the same time just getting in what is a much larger industry than it was 15 years ago for me.
So I'm going to summarize that by saying the utilities need to get with the program or they're going to go the way of Heinz.
It's possible.
All right. Is there anything else you want to say?
You know, I just appreciate you reaching out to individuals. This is the first podcast I've ever done, but it's just exciting to hear about all the folks that have been on your show. And I want you to keep it up, because you've, obviously we were talking, you've come from the energy space and you understand it, and you can talk KWH and VAR demand, I'm sure, until the cows come home. So I think having a technical lens on this has been very helpful too in advancing what is a much broader and bigger story.
I really appreciate that. Thank you. And you're welcome. Okay, I'm going to wrap this up, and I'm going to do that with a rap. I know you've listened to some, so you know it's coming. Okay, you didn't like the moving part reliance when you saw the space shuttle at the Philly Center of Science. You said, hey, we should do no harm. That's why you're wind powered at your family farm. There were some people that said, hey, you're doing this to us. So you got them excited by renting a bus. There's some waterways they're turning into a puddle. It's killing the bird and rodents. Thank God for that space shuttle. There's this thing with this Rastafarian. You remember it still. He said, you're harnessing the wind. That's God's will. Another thing I think that is super nifty is when it comes to island energy, you've got megawatts 50. Pip's stories about his experiences developing wind projects, from simplifying rights-of-way requirements to changing the opinions of residents about the impact of his projects to being excited to harnessing the will of God, Mon, were motivating and moving. If you have comments or questions about the podcast, visit my website at www.cravatenergyinnovations.com and drop me an email. I would love to hear from you. And if you're enjoying the Climate Champions podcast series, please subscribe, rate it 5 stars if you're an Apple user, and tell your climate-concerned friends about it. And if you're in San Diego and want to trade your concern about climate change for a few hours of some great laughs, most weekends I'm doing improv comedy at either the Old Town Improv Company or Finest City Improv or both. Contact me to confirm specific show dates. And if you want to release from some of life's stress or to improve your speaking skills, consider taking a workshop at an improv club in your town. Pip witnessed the space shuttle's emissions and thought there was a better way. He persevered to get a job in renewable energy, the industry he was passionate about, relocated to get into the business, traveled almost every week while his wife was pregnant, and continues to follow his dream, building more solar, wind, and energy storage projects that replace diesel-generated energy on islands and help to mitigate climate change.